You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Jake Jacobson. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, April 21st, 2021.
Later in the program, we have an excerpt from our public affairs program, Interchange, a show that questions how we understand ourselves. Today's excerpt comes from last week's show, Mr. Trotter, the President, and the Klan, with Kerry Greenidge. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog program hosted and produced by Richard Fish. But first, your daily news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Wednesday, April 21st. I'm Aaron Comforti. The core building on Rogers in between 1st and 2nd Streets just moved closer in the process to being redeveloped into what the City of Bloomington calls affordable housing. The City of Bloomington bought the building as a part of a deal which saw the city buy the old Bloomington Hospital site on 2nd Street from IU Health. Earlier this year, the Bloomington City Council voted unanimously to give the 120-year-old core building an historic status. The developers who won the bidding process submitted a proposal to the city that would set aside a number of permanent supportive housing units for people experiencing homelessness. Since the beginning of the pandemic last March, Bloomington Transit has offered its public bus services free of charge. Yesterday, however, Doug Horn, one of the Bloomington Transit board members, considered reinstating the bus fares at the transit board meeting. Lou May, Bloomington Transit's general manager, had earlier said that drivers support a return to fares because they have seen an increase in disruptions on buses caused by people experiencing homelessness. In an opinion piece in the B-Square Beacon, Dave Askins wrote, quote, "Surely the disruptive behavior on buses of some individuals experiencing homelessness should not guide our policy choices on bus fares," end quote. Askins went on to note that fares account for only about 4% of last year's Bloomington Transit budget. Another 7% or so of the budget came from Indiana University's contribution to Bloomington Transit. Indiana University students and faculty and staff ride for free. They don't have to pay any fares. After some public comment at the board meeting, the board ultimately voted to extend the free rides until at least May 18th of this year. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Comforti.
The Bloomington Board of Public Safety talked about new hires at the Bloomington Police Department. Bloomington Police Chief Michael Dekoff announced that the BPD has hired its second social worker at the April 20th meeting. He revealed that a third social worker will join the police department in May.
Just for your information, our third social worker will start in the middle of May. She's not started yet. She's just graduating from IU. So by the middle of May, we will have three social workers on staff, and we intend to increase the number of hours that we have department coverage and to hopefully increase the outreach that they do also.
Board member Luis Fuentes Roer was surprised the Bloomington Police Department had made two new hires without presenting them to the board. Dekoff clarified the board only needs to approve the hiring of sworn officers, not civilian positions. The next Board of Public Safety meeting is on May 18th.
Health officials are warning of the highly transmissible B.1.17 variant of COVID-19. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Indiana has seen 269 COVID-19 variant cases. The CDC says that 263 of those cases are the B.1.17 variant first identified in the United Kingdom. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky talked about an increase in COVID-19 cases across the U.S. She said variants are part of the reason for the increase.
The increasing trends in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are very concerning, and they threaten the progress we've already made. As I've discussed, some of these increases are as a result of relaxed prevention efforts in states across the country, such as relaxed mask mandates or loosened restrictions on indoor restaurant seating. Another reason for these increases is the continued spread of highly transmissible variants, more than 50 to 70% more transmissible, which makes the race to stop the transmission even more challenging and threatens to overwhelm our healthcare system again in parts of this country. CDC data show that the B.1.1.7 variant, the variant originally identified in the United Kingdom, represents 44% of the virus circulating during the week of March 27th. The prevalence of B.1.1.7 since that time is certainly higher, and we are expected to have new data soon. The emergence of variants underscores the critical need for rapid and ongoing genomic surveillance. CDC has been acting on multiple fronts to increase our sequencing efforts in the United States to detect variants of the virus that cause COVID-19, and recently began receiving sequence data from 7 additional large commercial laboratories. As Andy just announced, the administration is investing $1.7 billion from the American Rescue Plan in an effort to more effectively track emerging and circulating variants across the country and to better prepare the country for the next pandemic. This includes surveillance of breakthrough infections, as well as more and more people get vaccinated.
Monroe County remains in the yellow advisory for the 4th consecutive week in a row. During last Friday's COVID-19 press conference, Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said the B.1.17 variant is the most popular variant across the United States and in Indiana.
When I speak about community spread, I also have to talk a little bit about the variants. The B.1.1.7, the UK variant, is now the most common variant we're seeing in the United States and in Indiana. The California variant is what we're seeing second most often. And the state's dashboard is now kind of tracking. There's the vaccine tracker tracks some of those variants and the percentage that's sequenced. So we can kind of see what's going on with those variants. It is more transmissible. So again, that's the reason that we need to continue to wear our masks at the moment. While we're still getting people vaccinated, even if we may have been vaccinated. If you have been fully vaccinated and you are visiting in your home with someone else who's fully vaccinated, you can be a little more relaxed than you were 4 or 5 months ago. But when you are out in public, we still need you to be following these precautions for the good of everyone.
The CDC lists 5 variants of concern, the most prevalent of which includes the B.1.17 variant. According to the CDC, the B.1.17 variant increases transmission by about 50%. The variant likely increases severity of cases based on hospitalizations and case fatality rates. According to a UK study, infection with the variant may increase the risk of death by 60%. However, the CDC says more data is needed to confirm this. Although there was some speculation that vaccines were not effective against mutations of the B.1.17 variant, recent evidence is pointing to the contrary. According to data from a UK clinical trial, it suggests that the AstraZeneca vaccine is 70% effective against the B.1.17 variant, while being 80% effective against non-variant strains. The CDC says, quote, "Early reports found no evidence to suggest that the variant has any impact on the severity of the disease or vaccine efficacy," end quote. Meanwhile, local officials are still encouraging masks and social distancing in public places, despite the ease of restrictions on the state level. Director of Public Engagement Mary Catherine Carmichael reminded local residents to continue health and safety precautions against the virus during last Friday's COVID-19 press conference.
I will tell you that we are hearing from folks some concerns about the confusion between the governor's orders and our local orders. You may or may not be aware that the governor recently made it no longer mandatory to wear a mask in Indiana. That having been said, the Board of Health here in Monroe County and certainly within the city of Bloomington, we've decided that, hey, you know what? the approach that we've been taking over time has been working beautifully. We're going to stick with this. We know we're not out of the woods. So for those of us in Monroe County, let's continue to wear those masks. We know it's kind of confusing. So to that end, the city of Bloomington is deploying some message boards, kind of in some critical arteries inside town to remind people that, hey, here in Monroe County, we're still wearing those masks. We're still taking care of each other in that way and protecting ourselves and each other and those folks who are visiting. So we do anticipate, especially at this time of year when the weather is so beautiful and blue, what's more beautiful than a town named Bloomington at this time of year, right? So we got a lot of people here who want to take advantage of our beauty and we love that, but we do need to remind some of our neighbors who may be visiting that, hey, here in Monroe County, we still mask up.
The CDC says that public health officials are studying all variants of concern to learn more about how to control their spread.
The Monroe County Plan Commission discussed updates to the planned unit development of Southern Meadows. At the April 20th meeting, County Planner Drew Myers revealed plan staff recommended the commission deny the outline plan due to its density and lack of usable open space.
Overall, planning staff still recommends denial based on the findings of fact and subject to Monroe County Highway and Drainage Engineer Report, specifically finding B, which states the extent to which the proposal departs from zoning and subdivision regulations, such as density, dimension, bulk, use, ground improvements, and construction and design standards, with the remaining concerns listed below, requesting small-scale commercial use so that it is truly a PUD and not just higher density housing. The petitioner had communicated with planning staff that they were under the impression that having Clear Creek Urban, which is yet not approved completely, that is directly to the west, may allow for that type of commercial use, neighborhood commercial use, to work together with that. And then comprehensive plan recommendations. Again, the architectural diversity and standards should be set forth in the outline plan. To consider including a diversity of housing types. Although the petitioner has provided some details about variety in the structures and architectural standards, we still need to see that directly represented in the outline plan document itself so that it can become enforceable. And then also based on the plan submitted, it appears there will be a street tree conflict. Another conversation with the petitioner and planning staff again regarding this one, and we feel now planning staff we'll be able to address this during the development plan stage of the petition. And then finally, the petitioner verbally stated that they would prepare the Rose property bridge to provide connectivity to the property's pedestrian trail. And we just wanted to remind the petitioner of that commitment and bring it up into discussion for this proposal.
Commissioner Margaret Clemens raised concerns over the data used in the presentation. She said 10-year-old data is not reliable enough to support building in an area with sinkholes.
I would call, for instance, some of the data that is presented in the report as an extrapolation on a speculation that by now is almost 10 years old. So while that might have been our best guess at that time, we have new information. And that new information pertains to growth in Bloomington, although it's often claimed without supporting data that that we have a solid 1% growth rate. Actually, in the state, we have a 1% growth rate in some markets, and that's not Bloomington. Bloomington has probably, 0.7% growth rate. So although this is optimistic and it would be beautiful if true, I just am challenging wholesale acceptance of this data and also the changing dynamics with all the housing that has been built in the city. So I don't think that we can take at face value something that pertained in 2012 to what is actually going on in the city right now and in the county and in our community. And certainly I would challenge the justification for further density, especially on a sinkhole conservancy area, as something that would be in the best interest of the community.
Clements showed concern that this PUD would potentially set a homeowners association up for failure. She said the water drainage could be too expensive. Commissioner Jeff McKim argued that the proposed density of housing would financially strengthen a homeowners association.
The drainage issues aren't going to be increased by having more paired patio homes on the same amount of impervious surface. I mean, in fact, if anything, the additional number of residences could improve the financial stability of any homeowners association that would still have the same amount of impervious surface to deal with.
Commissioner David Schilling motioned to move further discussion to the May 4th Plan Commission meeting. Commissioners approved the motion unanimously.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, we have an excerpt from our public affairs program, Interchange, a program that gets to the questions that shape how we understand ourselves. Today's excerpt comes from last week's episode, Mr. Trotter, the President, and the Klan, with Carrie Greenidge. You can find the full program online at WFHB.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Interchange airs each Tuesday at 6 p.m. on WFHB Community Radio.
In 1901, he started the Guardian newspaper and basically argues that the job of the press was to hold people in power accountable, even if those people was somebody like a Booker T. Washington. And so he started to expose a lot of the ways in which Tuskegee, and it was called the Tuskegee Machine, was buying out Black newspapers, the way that Booker T. Washington was stifling dissent. And so Trotter pointing out things like that. Pointing out the rise of lynching. So this is at a time when the mainstream press was actually not covering lynchings as much as they were in the past, with the argument that, according to Booker T. Washington, that it was just inciting more violence. So why report on anti-Black violence? And so Trotter, very skillfully using Black communities to report on the everyday violence that occurred in addition to lynching across the South. And so by the time you get to like within 2 years of the newspaper, the Guardian was extremely popular for the way that it talked to Black communities and the way that it urged Black communities to agitate against segregation, discrimination, and lynching. Mm-hmm. And by the 1903, he's turning the newspaper into a vehicle for what he calls his Equal Suffrage League, which was going to use the press to get Black people to create a national organization that would fight for restoration of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And, you know, by 1905, it's a vehicle that then leads to the Niagara Movement, which was a predecessor to the NAACP.
Trotter begins to see it as a way to be active, to bring things to light, but also to encourage other activism, in a sense, you know, or to encourage his readers to agree that they could be agents in their lives, in politics, in their communities, that they didn't have to accept what anybody was saying that they mm-hmm. should or shouldn't do. One of the things, you know, points he makes throughout and you make throughout is he's not going to tell you what to do. He's just going to say, look what's going on here. And we're going to have some rallies. You know, a big part of the book is just how great he is at creating these events to raise money, to raise awareness. That was pretty impressive as well.
I'm glad you pointed that out. I mean, one of the things I've always struck me about Trotter is that he never told people vote for this candidate except for one candidate, and that was President Woodrow Wilson. And then after that, he never did that again. But he never said, you know, you have to vote for this person. He was saying that Black people and communities need to decide how it was they wanted to live. And to do that, they need to know what was actually happening, you know, politically, economically, and socially. And so the biggest claim to fame for the Guardian was it's his ability to rally masses of people to show what we would now call like civil disobedience. Using the newspaper, and again, this is before even widespread telephone use at the time, so it's pretty amazing. You know, we're having a rally in Boston Common so that Massachusetts will pass an anti-lynching bill. Show up at this time, and he'd get, you know, 300 people at the least, you know, 1,000 people at the most, all Black people. And then as the years went on, more white people joining the crowds to protest on behalf of these things. And that was really something that people hadn't seen before.
So you mentioned the Niagara Movement already as being a sort of precursor to the NAACP. The Niagara Movement's 29 men in particular, right? Du Bois and Trotter being two of these. That's 1905. What was its intention?
So the Niagara Movement was created in part in response to the fact that You have this national, this equal suffrage league that Trotter starts that ends up spreading to other areas. There's one in New York. There's a branch in, of course, all over New England, New York, Philadelphia. And yet every time they try to have a mass movement to have people show up, Tuskegee and Booker T. Washington will interfere and, you know, urge people not to go. And so that was one of the reasons that they wanted to create the Niagara Movement. The other reason is that in 1903, there's something called the Boston Riot, in which Trotter attempts to ask Booker T. Washington questions in Boston. There's a riot. When that happens, Trotter was sued by Booker T. Washington in an attempt to get rid of the Guardian. And so there was really this idea that something had to be done with the fact that Tuskegee was stifling dissent. The Niagara Movement emerged as that. It wanted to be an entirely Black-led organization so that these Black communities could decide what this like civil rights national agenda should look like. And they wanted to restore the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And with the fight and argument between Du Bois and Trotter, by about 1909, the Niagara Movement was defunct. At its height, the Niagara Movement had branches in Atlanta, New York, New England, Ohio. Its biggest triumph was that it challenged successfully segregated cars in Virginia. That did not stick because eventually Virginia went back and reinstated a form of segregation. But it sort of had this initial success. Once the Niagara Movement ended around 1908, 1909, the instances of racial violence increased. And one of those was a very brutal lynching in 1908 in Springfield, Illinois. Ironically, the hometown or near where Abraham Lincoln was from. Mm-hmm. And in that riot, the white townspeople basically, you know, attacked the Black townspeople, forced them out of the city of Springfield, and rioted against sort of any Black presence in the community. And so this was a moment when many white Northerners for the first time recognized that lynching was a problem because it occurred in a city that was supposed to be racially tolerant.
Members don't get weary. Members don't get weary.
I just had a conversation with Walter Johnson not that long ago about his book, The Broken Heart of America.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful book.
And, yeah. And one of those, you know, he just details an East St. Louis riot that is very, very similar to the Springfield riot, except, you know, one I think has more to do with labor. I mean, obviously racist labor issues, but the fact that, you know, the riot itself creates people who become refugees as they have nowhere to go. The city's turned over basically, and people are forced to leave and murdered. And like 5,000 people participated in the riot, 2,000 refugees, 19 or 20 people murdered that they're or killed that they're aware of. I mean, and I had never heard of it. And there are too many of those that, you know, we don't hear of.
You know, when you bring up these happen all the time, I mean, one of the things even in research in the book was that Trotter would do something, and often I would then have to go back and say, well, why is he doing it? It has to be something that he's doing it for. It was usually some act of, you know, horrendous anti-Black violence that occurred that nobody else except for a few small other people were covering. And then when he started to cover it, then, you know, other places would start to cover it as well. But he was very sort of this kind of constant barrage of violence was definitely a theme that he saw as the reason why voting and political action and radical, you know, politics were so much needed.
Necessary, yeah. So why does Niagara turn into the NAACP? I mean, we can say why it fell apart, I suppose, also, because a big part of the book is Trotter's own personality, which is, very, as you say, very difficult. But why did an all-Black organization, you know, all-Black men, we should always point out that it's men doing these things also. How can that turn into basically a white organization?
So it's a good question. So Niagara Movement itself falls apart roughly by, you know, 1908, 1909. At the same time it's falling apart, there was the Springfield riot. And in response, a group of white philanthropists in New York, Mary White Ovington, you know, a seasoned, these are sort of reformers. You mentioned at the beginning of our talk, you know, liberal New England people, a lot of those little type of people, they're shocked. They have a meeting called a conference on the status of the Negro, in which they're like, okay, we're going to have this meeting in New York. We're going to figure out why it is that the Southern problem, as they called it, is seeping into the North. We're going to have a conference about it. And so that was the origins of what then became the NAACP, as it was called by white philanthropists. It met in New York. At the time, the people who met there were really concerned with choosing the people who would be there. And Trotter initially was invited, as was Ida B. Wells Barnett, as was W.E.B. Du Bois. But Trotter quickly reveals that he and Ida B. Wells have a very, very different prescription for what they want this to look like, right? So if the white philanthropists are really want this to be, we're going to go investigate, we're going to then get a team of lawyers, those lawyers are going to then prosecute segregation, we're going to make a case for civil rights as a legal issue. So that was what originally the original NAACP was supposed to do, and still does, and does it very well. You know, this isn't to disparage the organization for any means. Trotter's argument was that that was not sufficient, particularly if by the time it's created in 1909, by that time, everyone in charge of it were white people. All of those people were white Northerners. Majority of those people were white Northerners from either New York or New England. And the only Black person asked to lead anything was Du Bois, and he's put in charge of the magazine called The Crisis. And so Trotter and other Black activists' argument was that, you know, why do you not have Black people who are activists in the room leading the charge and directing things? You know, we have Black attorneys at the time who were fighting on the civil rights level. Why aren't they involved? And so that was Trotter's and many Black, his Black supporters' initial criticism. Trotter was also critical of the approach of the NAACP because it was focused on legal mechanisms of ending segregation and lynching and discrimination, that it really didn't deal with kind of community level stuff. And Trotter's argument was that to not do that was to ignore sort of Black people themselves. And so by the time the NAACP is founded, Trotter's criticism of it, particularly in Boston, was that it was very allied with seeking out white liberal philanthropists and their money, right, and getting them to support these legal initiatives, which were very much removed then as they are now from kind of average people's lives.
Up next, we have Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment hosted and produced by our very own Richard Fish. In today's episode, our host walks us through the topic of recalls and extortionware. Richard Fish has more.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
What happens when you buy something that doesn't work right or turns out to be dangerous? A lot of times these days, the product gets recalled. Of course, cars get recalled pretty often. Honda just issued recalls for over 600,000 recent models. But lots of other things get recalled, too, and you ought to be aware when that happens. There's a website you can check at the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Get something to write with, and I'll give you the website in a moment. Recent recalls have included bicycles, off-road vehicles, motorcycles, candles, mattresses, toys, garden sprayers, essential oils, bunk beds, and propane cylinders. And there are more all the time. You can do a quick search for the Consumer Product Safety Commission and find their website. But if you're ready to take a note, you can go to cpsc.gov/recalls. That's cpsc.gov/recalls. Currently, the website has 9 pages of recalled products, but it's searchable. There are prescription drugs, folding tables, children's helmets, snowblowers, computer cases, shelving units, all kinds of things that you may have bought or are considering buying. Once again, the website is cpsc.gov/recalls. Check it today, and you might want to bookmark it for future reference. And there's a new trend in nasty online malware that's very worrying. Now, you've heard of ransomware, a truly evil program that can encrypt all the data on your computer so you can't get at it until you pay the crooks. Ransomware can attack your computer if you click on a link in a fake email or sometimes simply visit the wrong website. And this tactic hauled in over $170 billion last year. Well, now the bad guys have started to ramp up the threat with something called extortionware. What happens is this. If your computer, or the one you use at work, gets hacked, the crook doesn't lock up your data. Instead, he downloads it, and then goes through it with a sophisticated search program looking for anything that might be embarrassing. One of the most common things is when they find pornography on someone's computer or evidence that the computer has visited pornographic websites. But that's not the only thing that they can act on. Lists of private information about customers and clients, anything that suggests criminal behavior like insurance fraud or tax fraud. If the hackers find anything like that, you get a very personal email threatening to publish or expose whatever it is, unless you cough up some big bucks. The extortionware crooks are sophisticated international gangs, not just individuals. Keeping a computer secure against these threats is everybody's business. You need to have a good antivirus program. You need to be very careful about opening suspicious emails. You need to have separate, strong passwords for every online account. And all the time, you had better beware. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.